again. Hi, this is Ms. G. I'm back bringing you Telling Tales here at KTO 104.3. And tonight, my first story is called Quail Seed by Saki. The outlook is not encouraging us for smaller businesses, said Mr. Skerrick to the artist and his sister, who had taken rooms over his suburban grocery store. These big concerns are offering all sorts of attractions to the shopping public, which we couldn't afford to imitate even on a small scale. Reading rooms and playrooms and gramophones and heaven knows what. People don't care to buy half a pound of sugar nowadays unless they can listen to Harry Lauder and have the latest Australian cricket scores ticked off before their eyes. With the big Christmas stock we've got in, we ought to keep half a dozen assistants hard at work, but as it is, my nephew Jimmy and myself can pretty well attend to it ourselves. It's a nice stock of goods, too, if I could only run it off in a few weeks' time. But there's no chance of that, not unless the London line was to get snowed up for a fortnight before Christmas. I did have a sort of idea of engaging Miss Lufcombe to give recitations during afternoons. She made a great hit at the post office entertainment with her rendering of Little Beatrice's Resolve. Anything less likely to make your shop a fashionable shopping center, I can't imagine, said the artist with a very genuine shudder. If I were trying to decide between the merits of Carlsbad plums and confected figs as a winter dessert, it would infuriate me to have my train of thought entangled with Little Beatrice's Resolve to be an angel of light or a Girl Scout. No, he continued, the desire to get something thrown in for nothing is a ruling passion with the feminine shopper, but you can't afford to pander effectively to it. Why not appeal to another instinct, which dominates not only the woman shopper, but the male shopper, in fact, the entire human race? What is that instinct, sir? Said the grocer. Mrs. Gray's and Miss Fritton had missed the 2:18 to town, and as there was not another train till 3:12, they thought they might as well make their grocery purchases at Skerrick's. It would not be sensational, they agreed, but it would still be shopping. For some minutes, they had the shop almost to themselves, as far as customers were concerned, but while they were debating the respective virtues and blemishes of two competing brands of anchovy paste, they were startled by an order given across the counter for 6 pomegranates and a packet of quail seed. Neither commodity was in general demand in that neighborhood. Equally unusual was the style and appearance of the customer, about 16 years old, with dark olive skin, large dusky eyes, and thick, low-growing blue-black hair. He might have made his living as an artist model. As a matter of fact, he did. The bowl of beaten brass that he produced for the reception of his purchases was distinctly the most astonishing variation on the string bag or marketing basket of suburban civilization that his fellow shoppers had ever seen. He threw a gold piece, apparently of some exotic currency, across the counter and did not seem disposed to wait for any change that might be forthcoming. The wine and figs were not paid for yesterday, he said. Keep what is over for the money for our future purchases. A very strange-looking boy, said Mrs. Gray interrogatively to the grocer as soon as his customer had left. A foreigner, I believe, said Mr. Skerrick, with a shortness that was entirely out of keeping with his usual communicative manner. I wish for a pound and a half of the best coffee you have, said an authoritative voice a moment or two later. The speaker was a tall, authoritative-looking man of rather outlandish aspect, remarkable among other things for a full black beard worn in a style more in vogue in early Assyria than in a London suburb of the present day. Has a dark-faced boy been here buying pomegranates? He asked suddenly as the coffee was being weighed out to him. The two ladies almost jumped on hearing the grocer reply with an unblushing negative. We have a few pomegranates in stock, he continued, but there has been no demand for them. My servant will fetch the coffee as usual, said the purchaser, producing a coin from a wonderful metalwork purse. As an apparent afterthought, he fired out the question, Have you perhaps any quail seed? No, said the grocer without hesitation. We don't stock it.
Why
"What will he deny next?" asked Mrs. Graves under her breath. What made it seem so much worse was the fact that Mr. Skerrick had quite recently presided at a lecture on Savonarola. Turning up the deep Astrachan collar of his long coat, the stranger swept out of the shop with the air, Miss Fritton afterwards described it, of a satrap proroguing a Sanhedrin. Whether such a pleasant function ever fell to a satrap's lot, she was not quite certain, but the simile faithfully conveyed her meaning to a large circle of acquaintances. "Don't let's bother about the 312, said Mrs. Graves. "Let's go and talk this over at Laura Lipping's. It's her day." When the dark-faced boy arrived at the shop next day with his brass marketing bowl, there was quite a fair gathering of customers, most of whom seemed to be spinning out their purchasing operations with the air of people who had very little to do with their time. In a voice that was heard all over the shop, perhaps because everybody was intently listening, he asked for a pound of honey and a packet of quail seed. "More quail seed?" said Miss Fritton. "Those quails must be voracious, or else it isn't quail seed at all." "I believe it's opium, and the bearded man is a detective," said Mrs. Graves brilliantly. "I don't," said Laura Lipping. "I'm sure it's something to do with the Portuguese throne." "More likely to be a Persian intrigue on behalf of the ex-Shah," said Miss Fritton. "The bearded man belongs to the government party. The quail seed is a countersign, of course. Persia is almost next door to Palestine, and quails come into the Old Testament, you know." "Only as a miracle," said her well-informed younger sister. "I thought all along it was part of a love intrigue." The boy, who had so much interest and speculation centered on him, was on the point of departing with his purchases when he was waylaid by Jimmy, the nephew apprentice, who, from his post at the cheese and bacon counter, commanded a good view of the street. "We have some very fine Jaffa oranges," he said hurriedly, pointing to a corner where they were stored behind a high rampart of biscuit tins. There was evidently more in the remark than met the ear. The boy flew at the oranges with the enthusiasm of a ferret finding a rabbit family at home after a long day of fruitless subterranean research. Almost at the same moment, the bearded stranger stalked into the shop and flung an order for a pound of dates and a tin of the best Smyrna Hava across the counter. The most adventurous housewife in the locality had never heard of Hava, but Mr. Skerrick was apparently able to produce the best Smyrna variety of it without a moment's hesitation. "We might be living in the Arabian Nights," said Miss Fritton excitedly. "Hush, listen," beseeched Mrs. Graves. "Has the dark-faced boy, of whom I spoke yesterday, been here today?" asked the stranger. "We've had rather more people than usual in the shop today," said Mr. Skerrick, "but I can't recall a boy such as you describe." Mrs. Graves and Miss Fritton looked round triumphantly at their friends. It was, of course, deplorable that anyone should treat the truth as an article temporarily and excusably out of stock. But they felt gratified that the vivid accounts they had given of Mr. Skerrick's traffic and falsehoods should receive confirmation at first hand. "I shall never again be able to believe what he tells me about the absence of coloring matter in the jam," whispered an aunt of Mrs. Gray's tragically. The mysterious stranger took his departure. Laura Lipping distinctly saw a snarl of battled rage reveal itself behind his heavy mustache and upturned Astrachan collar. After a cautious interval, the seeker after oranges emerged from behind the biscuit tins, having apparently failed to find any individual orange that satisfied his requirements. He, too, took his departure, and the shop was slowly emptied of its parcel and gossip-laden customers. It was Emily Yorling's day, and most of the shoppers made their way to her drawing room. To go direct from a shopping expedition to a tea party was what one was known locally as living in a whirl. Two extra assistants had been engaged for the following afternoon, and their services were in brisk demand. The shop was crowded. People bought and bought, never seemed to get to the end of their list. Mr. Skerrick had never had so little difficulty in persuading customers to embark on new experiences in grocery wares. Even those women whose purchases were of modest proportions dawdled over them as though they had brutal, drunken husbands to go home to. The afternoon had dragged uneventfully on, and there was a distinct buzz of unpent excitement when a dark-eyed boy carrying a brass bowl entered the shop. The excitement seemed to have communicated itself to Mr. Skerrick, abruptly deserting a lady who was making insincere inquiries about the home life of the Bombay duck. He intercepted the newcomer on his way to the accustomed counter and informed him amid a death-like hush that he had run out of quail seed. The boy looked nervously round the shop and turned hesitantly to go. He was again intercepted, this time by the nephew, who darted out from behind his counter and said something about a better line of oranges. The boy's hesitation vanished. He almost scuttled into the obscurity of the orange corner. There was an expectant turn of public attention towards the door, and the tall, bearded stranger made a really effective entrance. The aunt of Mrs. Gray's declared afterwards that she found herself subconsciously repeating, "The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold," under her breath, and she was generally believed. The newcomer, too, was stopped before he reached the counter, but not by Mr. Skerrick or his assistant. A heavily veiled lady, whom no one had hitherto noticed, rose languidly from its seat and greeted him in a clear, penetrating voice. "Your Excellency does his shopping himself," she said. "I order the things myself," he explained. "I find it very difficult to make my servants understand." In a lower but still perfectly audible voice, the veiled lady gave him a piece of casual information. "They have some excellent Jaffa oranges here." Then with a tinkling laugh, she passed out of the shop. The man glared all round the shop, and then fixing his eyes instinctively on the barrier of biscuit tins, demanded loudly of the grocer, "You have perhaps some good Jaffa oranges?" Everyone expected an instant denial on the part of Mr. Skerrick of any such possession. Before he could answer, however, the boy had broken forth from his sanctuary. Holding his empty brass bowl before him, he passed out into the street. His face was variously described afterwards as masked with studied indifference, overspread with ghastly pallor, and blazing with defiance. Some said that his teeth chattered, others that he went out whistling the Persian national hymn. There was no mistaking, however, the effect produced by the encounter on the man who had seemed to force it. If a rabid dog or rattlesnake had suddenly thrust its companionship on him, he could scarcely have displayed a greater access of terror. His air of authority and assertiveness had gone. His masterful stride had given way to a furtive pacing to and fro, and as of an animal seeking an outlet for escape. In a dazed, perfunctory manner, always with his eyes turning to watch the shop entrance, he gave a few random orders, which the grocer made a show of entering into his book. Now and then he walked out into the street, looked anxiously in all directions, and hurried back to keep up his pretense of shopping. From one of these sorties he did not return. He had dashed away into the dusk, and neither he nor the dark-faced boy nor the veiled lady were seen again by the expectant crowds that continued to throng the Skerrick establishment for days to come. "I can never thank you and your sister sufficiently," said the grocer. "We enjoyed the fun of it," said the artist modestly. "And as for the model, it was a welcome variation on poking for hours for the lost Hylas." "At any rate," said the grocer, "I insist on paying for the hire of the black beard." I hope you enjoyed that story by Saki. That was called Quail Seed. This is Telling Tales with Ms. G, and I will be right back for another story. Stay tuned. Thank you. Hello, this is Ms. G back with Telling Tales here at KDO 104.3. I hope you enjoyed that last story and hope you will enjoy this one as well. This is called The Spirit of Emulation and it is by Fernando Sorrentino and translated from the Spanish by Thomas C. Meehan. Among the inhabitants of the apartment building on Paraguay Street where I live, the spirit of emulation is quite intense. It's true that for a long time they limited themselves to rivaling one another in dogs, cats, canaries, or parrots. The most exotic among them never went beyond little squirrels or a turtle. I myself had a beautiful German shepherd named Joey that was just slightly smaller than our apartment. However, besides Joey, and this was something completely unknown, there lived with my wife and me a lovely spider of the species, Lycosa pampinea. One morning at 9 o'clock, while I was feeding my pet, the neighbor from 7C, whom I had never seen before, came by to borrow my newspaper for a moment, for who knows what confused reason. Afterwards, without managing to leave, he just stood there for a long time with the newspaper in his hand. He was staring, fascinated, at Gertrude, and in his stare there was something that made me shudder. It was the spirit of emulation. The next day he came by to show me the scorpion he had just bought. In the hallway, the maid of the people who live in 7D overheard our dialogue on the life, habits, and feedings of spiders, scorpions, and ticks. That very afternoon, her employers acquired a crab. Then for a week, there was nothing new of note, until one evening, when I happened to be on the elevator with one of the neighbor women on the third floor, a languid young blonde with one of those vacant stares in her eyes. She was carrying a big yellow purse, the zipper of which was partially broken. Every little while, through one of the breaks, there would poke out the tiny head of a golden yellow lizard. The following noon, as I was returning from the grocery store, the bags almost flipped out of my hands when I bumped headlong into the large ant bear, our ant eater, which was being lowered from a truck en route to the doorman's office. One of the many onlookers who had congregated there mumbled in a voice loud enough to be heard that in truth the ant bear was not a real bear. The attorney's wife looked startled at this and ran, trembling, to take refuge in her apartment. I didn't see her reappear until a few days later when, with a radiant and disdainful face, she came out to sign the receipt for the freight delivery man who had just brought her an American brown bear. My situation was now becoming untenable. The neighbors denied me their greetings, the butcher refused me credit, and I was receiving insulting anonymous letters every day. Finally, when my wife threatened me with separation, I realized I could no longer endure an insignificant Lycosa pampinea a single day more. I then entered upon an unprecedented round of activities. I borrowed money from several friends. I became indescribably frugal. I stopped smoking. In this way, I was able to purchase the most marvelous leopard you can imagine. Immediately, the fellow in 7C, who always followed right in my footsteps, tried to outdo me with a jaguar. And although it may seem illogical, he succeeded. What hurts me most is dealing with people who lack aesthetic sensitivity, people who don't perceive quality, people who are merely quantitative. There wasn't a single neighbor who bowed before the superior beauty of my leopard. Their understanding had been blinded by the greater size of the jaguar. At once, all the neighbors, spurred on by the boastful air of the jaguar's owner, gave themselves over to renewing their animals. I had to recognize that my humble leopard no longer provided me with my former status. In the face of stealthy telephone conversations my wife was having with some anonymous gentleman, I saw that my only alternative was ironclad. With no remorse whatsoever, I sold the furniture, the refrigerator, the washing machine, and the floor waxer. I even sold the television. In short, I sold everything that could be sold, and I bought an enormous anaconda boa constrictor. My poor man's life is hard. For only 3 days was I the hero of the building. My anaconda boa broke every dike. It destroyed every sense of moderation. It brought down the most respected conventions. In all the apartments, there now multiplied lions, tigers, gorillas, crocodiles. Some even had black panthers. Those panthers, they don't even have in the municipal zoo. The whole building resounded with roaring, howling, and chattering. We spent the nights awake. It was impossible to sleep. The intermingled odors of felines, quadrumanes, reptiles, and ruminants turned the atmosphere unbreathable. Huge trucks brought tons of meat, fish, and vegetables. Life in the building on Paraguay Street became a little dangerous. After a very long time, I had a disturbing experience where I once again shared the elevator with the languid young neighbor woman on the third floor, who was now taking her Bengal tiger out for a walk around the block to go pee-pee. I recalled her lizard that stuck its tiny head out through an opening in the zipper. I felt moved to tenderness. How far behind we had left those first difficult and quixotic days of scorpions and crabs. Finally, there came a moment when nobody could be trusted. The doorman, under the tense surveillance of several of the apartment owners, washed his two-horned rhinoceros with soap and water out on the sidewalk, and then, as if nothing had happened, he herded it into his apartment. There was more than the man in 5A was accustomed to putting up with. A few hours later, he triumphantly ascended the stairs, leading his hippopotamus by its bridle. The building is now flooded and semi-destroyed. I am composing this report on the roof and unfavorable conditions. Every so often, I'm startled by the plaintive trumpeting of the elephant that lives with the people in 7A. I'm writing with my watch in view, since at 8-minute intervals I must take shelter amidst the ruins of the stairway so that the jet stream of vapor ejected by the blue whale in 7C does not ruin these pages. And I write with a certain uneasiness, being as I am under the imploring gaze of the giraffe in 7D, which by sticking its head up over the wall never ceases for even 1 second begging crackers from me. That was The Spirit of Emulation by Fernando Sorrentino, translated from the Spanish by Thomas E. Meehan. I hope you enjoy telling tales. This has been Ms. G, giving it to you from 104.3 KTOO in Juneau, Alaska. I'll leave you with some nice, wonderful music. Until next time, good night.
Thank you.